Good evening, good morning, and good afternoon, and welcome to the Hipsid Podcast with me, Rabbi Semcha, and our producer, Sherry Barkley.
Hey guys, welcome to season two.
Thank you, Sherry. Apparently this is season two. Okay, so to kick off season two, we have two guests. We are very blessed and honored to have returning guest, Vespa Stamper. Say hello, Vespa.
Howdy.
Okay, so do we have to read the bio again, or we can just direct the listeners to Vespa's episode? Okay, Chloe is saying read it. Okay, I'm going to read it. Okay, Vespa Stamper, again, you are a returning guest. You and Rabbi Teddy are the only two returning guests. So I'm going to reread the bio. Vespa Stamper was born in Nuremberg, Germany, raised in New York. Your family is an electric mix of engineers, musicians, and artists who don't think Voltaire is too tough for bedtime reading. Do I really have to read this? This is tough. Chopin too loud for wake-up calls, or precision side rules too fragile for place things. I don't even know what that means.
In other words, I come from a family of weirdos, a long line of weirdos.
Okay, yeah, Vespa Stamper comes from a long line of weirdos. Okay, our other guest today, I don't know why it's taken so long to get you on the show, but our second guest, dear friend of mine, dear friend of the community, dear friend of the synagogue, is Chloe Valdery. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Chloe, I got the bio.
Beautiful.
Okay, I'm reading it. Okay, so you ready?
Sure.
Okay, you look a little nervous, Chloe. No. She's like, no, I'm just bored. Okay, so Chloe, after having lectured in communities around the world on conflict resolution, interpersonal growth, and reconciliation in previously polarized spaces. What does that even mean? Okay, Chloe Valdery is taking her innovative theory of change, the theory of enchantment, from the non-profit sector to the corporate world, combining the psychology of persuasion with profound insights from household names in pop culture. Chloe's theory of enchantment is a philosophy that can help change agents and corporate leaders navigate an increasingly polarized world and help untapped human potential along the way. That was a real, real mouthful. I'm going back to Vespa over here. Okay, so yeah, this is a mouthful. Okay, so firstly, Chloe, let's get to origin stories. That's something very important to me. Tell the listeners how we first met.
I'm trying to remember. I think we met in shul.
Yes.
At Shabbat dinner.
Yes.
And you asked me to give a talk at the shul.
Yes.
We met through the Shmulevskis.
Right.
They brought me here.
So that's what I want to get to.
Shout out to Arthur and Allegra.
Right. There's a very fortuitous and slightly divine providence behind our connection. It begins with Arthur Shmulevsky, dear friend of the both of us. And for months, Arthur was telling me, you have to get Chloe to come to the synagogue. Chloe is a very renowned advocate for Israel and Israel activism and Israel involvement. Mm-hmm. So I said, great, let's have her over. And then Arthur told me the price. And I said, that's not great. Let's not have her over.
Yes.
And then the following Shabbat, Arthur tells me like an amazing story.
Yes.
Chloe.
Is this a story of how Arthur and I met?
Yes.
So Arthur reached out to me over Facebook and he was like, hey, I heard you're moving to New York, because I posted that I was moving to New York. And he was like, where did you move to? Now, keep in mind, I hadn't met Arthur yet when this conversation was happening, because he told me he was a fan. But so I was like, oh, I moved to Brooklyn. And he kept being persistent and asking, oh, where in Brooklyn? And then I was like, oh, around Washington Avenue. And then he was like, that's crazy. I live near Washington Avenue in Brooklyn, at Washington and Park. What's the address? Like, where do you live? And at this point, again, because I don't know Arthur, I'm very hesitant to answer the question. But after a while, I tell him, and he's like, dude, no way, you moved into my building. And then he's like, what floor are you on? And then my answer really gets, you know, I'm very hesitant. And then I eventually tell him the second floor. And he goes, dude, you moved onto my floor. And he's like, come say hi. And then I didn't respond to him.
Right.
So that's how I met Arthur Shpilowski.
So Arthur, who wanted you to come speak in the shul.
Yes.
Suddenly turns out you're neighbors.
Yes.
And not only did we get you in the shul, but I'd say at this point, you're a fixture.
Yeah.
Chloe, you've been to many, many Shabbat dinners.
Many, yes.
High holidays.
Yes.
You sat through Yom Kippur.
Several times.
Unbelievable. I know my own kids don't. I barely sit through Yom Kippur, and I'm leading Yom Kippur. So it's been a trip.
Yes.
And I have so many questions to ask you. And Vespa, feel free to chime in. By the way, it's a little bit bittersweet tonight, Vespa, because we're taking down your art from the synagogue gallery. So this is the final night that the shul will be adorned with your work.
Well,
so thank you for that.
It's been a real honor to have it here. I mean, really.
It's getting rave reviews. Rave review. In fact, it's like the weekly discussion as to the pictures, and people are very into the fading of the tiles in the bathroom piece.
Oh, I worked very hard on those tiles.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
So if you'd like to explain for our listener, Betzalel, how did you get the tiles?
It
might not be the best topic on an audio podcast to discuss the tiles of one panel of Vespa's book. Chloe, as a very noted, prominent advocate of Israel,
yes.
I'm curious to know what led you to choose Israel advocacy, and what draws you to the Jewish cause? Because I got to tell you, amongst the millennials, it may not be the most popular topic.
Mm. So you talked about origin stories, I guess. So I'm originally from New Orleans, Louisiana, born and raised.
Went to Tulane?
No, oh. University of New Orleans. But I have a lot of friends that went to Tulane.
Tulane.
And I was raised in a very atypical Christian family. Grew up observing a lot of Jewish customs as a Christian, including keeping a form of Shabbat. So went to church on Saturday instead of Sunday. Grew up not eating pork or shellfish. Grew up also keeping all the holy days. So the reason why you always see me in shul for Yom Kippur is because I've always kept Yom Kippur growing up.
You got that guilt thing. I see it.
I do have that guilt thing. Totally. You're totally right. Yeah. I never actually used that word to describe it, but you're right. Wow. Yeah. I'm much more optimistic.
Shared sense of suffering.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, collective.
Yeah.
So when I was about 15 years old, I started reading a lot of books by Leon Uris, who's a famous author who wrote a lot about Israel. And then when I got to college, I became involved in Israel advocacy because it was just a subject that I was interested in because of my upbringing and my general affinity for the Jewish people. And so
what was that like on campus in terms of the perception of Israel and the conflict? Was that a campus that had an anti-Israel movement or feel or?
Actually, not really.
So
the University of New Orleans was actually a pretty apathetic campus when it came to, actually most campuses are when it comes to this topic of Israel.
100%.
So the greater challenge was to dealing with indifference as opposed to antipathy. I'm happy I had that experience because out of that experience, I was able to develop an entire new approach to not just Israel advocacy, but like trying to better human relationships. When we're talking about hostile situations, we're talking about difficult conversations that two people who disagree with each other want to have or have to have. How do you have that in a productive way? Doing Israel advocacy at the University of New Orleans actually helped me develop some answers to those challenges.
Can I be honest?
Yeah.
To speak freely.
Yeah.
That's an extremely, I guess, self-aware, mature. I think back to when I was in college and oy vey. So conflict resolution was the last thing on my. How about Vespa? Were you into conflict resolution in college?
I'm into conflict in general. I love conflict. Actually, I was telling my husband this. Like, I really do love conflict because how else can you get
healthy conflict?
Yeah, healthy conflict. But how else can you get to the truth of a matter and grow and move on unless you have kind of necessary conflict sometimes?
Healthy, a dialogue, open, respectful.
Yeah. You know, I think as long as people are like of good faith and, you know, coming to the table in good faith, then, you know, it's good. I'm not afraid of it.
All right.
I welcome it.
Okay. Conflict resolution. Okay, this is a good. This is going to be a good discussion. So, Chloe, your interest in Israel, it's contemporary Israel, or was this rooted in, I guess, biblical story, biblical narrative, from your childhood?
Celebrating,
observing.
I guess to a certain extent, but I actually became interested in contemporary Israel in high school. So, I remember reading a book about Israeli society when I was about 16 years old, and it was specifically about modern Israel. So I'm sure it started from just being aware of the biblical stories growing up, but that morphed into an interest in the modern day society.
Vespa Stampa, how did you come to be interested in Israel?
Okay.
By the way, Sherry's Israeli.
Yes.
Shout out to Sherry, who's currently eating, what are you eating? How are the egg rolls, by the way, Sherry?
The egg rolls are delicious. I'm enjoying the kosher Chinese food. You know, I don't always eat. I just eat any kind of Chinese food. So it's great to actually have the what do you call it when it's like blessed, the
consecrated Chinese food.
Yes. Yeah. I want to get back. I want Vesper's response to this. But side note, my family came to Israel. We don't actually know when. It was sometime, I believe, in the 1700s or something like that. They settled in Tzfat and Rosh Pina, and they were one of the founders of Rosh Pina. They worked with the Arabs when it was called Jauni. And so I always have had a very complicated growing up in North America. It's always been really weird for me to listen to the narrative of everyone I know just didn't even think of Israel as existing before, you know, when it, anyway, whatever. I'll probably edit this out, but yeah, I'm a OG Israeli on my mom's side, and that makes things both interesting and complicated. I think 7.
Nice, nice.
Yeah, but the funny thing is my family, even though they're really, really from there, they're not very educated, so they're not interested in their own origins, which is really annoying for me. You know, I want to know when I go there. I'm like, tell me this. Who's this? Who's this? Where's this old picture from? Who's this? And they're like, who cares? And I'm like, I do. But I don't know. I guess when you aren't growing up with it, when you're away from it, it's more interesting to you. Not necessarily. We have like one journalist historian, but other than that, yeah, my grandma is just totally, she just wants to like go to she's like, what's on sale at Castro? And that's
okay. I have one side question, by the way. Firstly, I know, but it's not Vespa's podcast. So we're going to get there.
That
Vespa.
Is correct.
Two questions. Number one, it's beautiful to hear 7 generations of Israeli. That's really, really beautiful.
It's really cool.
It's very cool. Second question, we just ate some Chinese food, Hasidic Chinese food, and Sherry asked for the egg rolls and a Coke. They were out of Coke, so I had to get you the Mayim Chaim, which is a Hasidic Coke. So I just wanted to get your feedback, Sherry, on Mayim Chaim Hasidic Coke.
Is it truly living water?
Yeah. She's swigging it back right now. Gargling with the Coke. This is like a wine tasting. Literally, can we hurry up? It's dead air.
How's the bouquet?
Yeah, don't worry, we're going to edit this all out. This is all right, 7th generation, half Israeli over here on the Mayim Chaim Cola. It's a very good, it's less bitter than the regular Coca-Cola. If I see this in the shuk, I definitely buy this. I like this. It's nice. This is the best. This is the best, like we say. It's the best. Thank you. Hodara balach.
Eze yofi. Okay, I just want to say, Vespa, not only did I cut you off, That I live vicariously through Vespa. Vespa's basically everything that I dream of as a rider, and does it with grace and dignity. Vespa, you recently won yet another award. Since the last time you were on this podcast, I think you've actually been the recipient of, is that even a word? You've actually won about 17 awards. What was the most recent one? Tell the listeners. It was the Jewish Young Fiction Book of the Year.
It was, so I have three award nomination / finalist things. So
let's start from the beginning.
All right. So it was a nominee for the National Book Award, and then it was a finalist for the Morris Award, which is for debut YA fiction, and then it was a Golden Kite honor book from the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators, which is a huge honor because that's peer-reviewed, and most recently it won the Sydney Taylor Book Award. Yay!
I should tell the listeners that did not listen to our previous podcast that Vespa is the author and illustrator of What the Night Sings, a young adult graphic novel, which is available in all good bookstores. So, Vespa.
Yes.
What's your view on Israel?
I'm going to not answer that question exactly, but just to say... because I'm still formulating my understanding of Israel. I have just a lot more to learn. But similarly to growing up in a Jewish home and never talking about the Holocaust, we also never talked about Israel.
Interesting.
I'm making a lot of noise here. It was just not a topic of discussion in my house. And so I never really cared. And our best friends...
Have you been to Israel?
No. And in fact, if anyone wants to sponsor me to go, I'm taking donations.
All right, go fund me.
If there's any, you know, anyone who wants to be a patron of the arts and send me to Israel, I would love to go. Anyway, but...
We should just kick off a couple of those birthright students that don't really want to go, and exactly. You can take their place.
My brother went on birthright, but
okay. Vespa, anyway. Vespa, Israel. Growing up, Israel, it was a taboo subject.
It wasn't or taboo. Just, it just was just not relevant. We were too busy talking about Voltaire and Chopin and slide rules. Well. But it was, you know. But anyway, and our best friends across the street were Palestinian. And they were like my adopted family. Right. I spent more time at their house than my house.
It was like a Fawlty Towers. Don't mention the war.
Yes. And who's that guy, you know, is that Arafat on the wall? Yeah. So, but I just, you know, I never thought to ask. But anyway, it was only after I heard a lot of people quoting the Psalm, I think, that says, pray for the peace of Jerusalem.
Right.
And I thought, I guess maybe that's something I should do.
Right.
I didn't know why. I didn't necessarily care, but I started praying for the peace of Jerusalem, and my life changed.
Wow.
My life changed. I was in a car accident, but the result was this book. And I really can trace my life completely changing by praying that prayer.
Wow.
Yeah. So now I care deeply about Israel. I don't say very much about it, again, because I'm still learning, and I don't want to make huge pronouncements or anything, but yeah.
Wow. Okay.
That's getting the answer.
We're getting heavy. Okay. So Chloe, I want to ask you, so clearly you grew up with a love and an affinity to Judaism and the Jewish people, and in college that parlayed into Israel advocacy. But how did that grow into a professional career in Israel advocacy? We'll get into the theory of enchantment. I know you've been evolving, but so how did that interest grow to, you know, in a professional capacity?
It sort of grew by accident. I mean, at some point I was just doing public speeches about Israel and people were paying
How did that start? How'd you get paid? Who's paying?
So sophomore year in college, me and my friends, we threw like a rally for Israel on campus.
Your speaking fee is approximately triple
well
my speaking fee. And not that I'm bitter or anything.
I think but, that first of all, when I gave you that speaking fee,
that was in the cheap days.
No, well, I was going to say, number one, I probably was being a little obnoxious. And number two, those were my cheap days. but basically, I gave a speech that went semi-viral because it was filmed.
Huh.
And then
what
from
was the topic?
Just standing with Israel as anti-Semitism resurfaced in Europe. Because this was around 2012 when the shooting at Toulouse in Toulouse, France happened. So there was a lot of anti-Semitism resurfacing in Europe and sort of like raising awareness of that.
You gave a speech that, and you were not prepared for this to go viral.
No, I didn't know it was going to go viral. I just, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
And did that evoke opposition?
No, because, again,
that's always my fear, by the way. Like, as a campus rabbi, you know, I choose to kind of approach Israel organically, holistically. I'll do like an Israeli-themed Shabbat dinner. I'll throw out the shawarma and the falafels. But I'm always nervous to have a public, visible Israel program. I'm always scared I'm going to like awake a sleeping giant. And I figured there's no opposition. So why should I, which, you know, I'm not proud of actually. Yeah. It's something that I wrestle with. I just, you know, I find Pratt as a very, it's extremely open and welcoming to all viewpoints, but it's Israel can be taboo, it can be polarizing.
Sure.
So I'm scared to approach it, and I'm embarrassed to say that.
But do you
have to edit that?
Do you think that it will
be vulnerable?
I always have to edit my support of Israel. You know? Nice. Yeah, absolutely. I run, you know, I have a production studio media company. Most of the people on it are boycott Israel.
Really?
People. Yeah. I mean, not like, not crazy, not
yeah,
openly.
Do they know like you're Israeli?
Yeah, but seven I kind of, but here's the thing. Here's the thing. Yeah. That's when I pull out my seven generation card.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I just say, hey, look, I'm sorry. My family's just from here.
Yeah.
And then I show them some pictures of my grandma.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes we'll FaceTime and then I'll change the subject. But I can't.
There's so much,
you know,
to say
I respect what they're saying. I'm just, you know what I mean? I'm just saying like I haven't dedicated my life to researching it. Yeah. It was just something that I was born into and I love my family and they're good people and I've seen them take care. They would help anyone.
Yeah.
And when I mean that, I mean anyone.
Yeah.
If they needed that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So anyway, that's where I leave it.
Okay, that's a very Sarah Silverman, I love you, America moment for me, I think.
Sherry just apologized for being seventh generation Israeli.
So it's interesting that we're having this conversation because just some context so you understand where I'm coming from. I was in the Israel space, I mean, I'm still technically in the Israel space informally for 7 years, right? So these are the types of conversations that I had to sort of engage and endure for the past 7 years. And I sort of transitioned from being in Israel advocacy to Israel education, which is slightly different from Israel advocacy. Israel advocacy entails a discussion of a lot of what we're talking about right now, like asking about the UN and all of these different ways in which Israel is held to a double standard. But Israel education is really about the attempt to educate people on the interesting complexities of Israeli society and what Israeli society actually is and how it functions and the different groups in Israel and everyday life and all of these things. And it entails and requires the reading of Israeli literature and really engaging on an intimate level with the people of Israeli, of Israel, as opposed to having this idea of Israel as an abstraction that you can like, and the purpose of this exercise is to understand the difference between love and infatuation. So I think that when I first started, I was infatuated with Israel, or like because I didn't really understand Israel via the people. I understood it as this abstraction that was always in the media, that was always being attacked, and that was unfair. But as my awareness of Israel deepened, that infatuation grew into an actual love, right? And to love a country is to be aware of its incredible successes and also its challenging shortcomings and everything in between. And so I am less, because of that, I am actually less disturbed by all these other things going on, like by what's going on in the UN. And maybe that's wrong. Maybe I have fatigue because I've been in the Israel space for 7 years. But I actually think that because the way I think about Israel, my orientation about Israel has gone from Israel advocacy to Israel education. It doesn't actually bother me. Maybe it should, but it doesn't bother me every time something in the UN happens, because I'm much more interested in something that Amos Oz wrote about Israeli society, or that, you know, Edgar Carrot wrote about Israeli society. I'm much more interested by what's happening within the country itself, not what outsiders are saying. So I don't know if that makes sense, but
that does make sense. And on that note of engagement, I'm actually jealous of my relatives that live there because they don't have the neuroses that I do about it.
Yeah.
I mean, as a rabbi, I just celebrate Israel as God's gift to the Jewish people. Mm. And that may sound fundamental, and I'm certainly, you know, the least. I like to put the fun in fundamental. You see what I did, Vespa? You see what
you
I
anticipated
did?
That.
Yes, I can vouch for the fact that you.
So, I think what you're saying, this is what I'm hearing from you, Chloe.
Yeah.
I don't think it's fatigue. I think we can do things out of love or fear. And I think that what you're saying is you'd rather engage in a positive way, and talk about, you know, the beauty of Israel, and talk, you know, with pride about contemporary Israel. And certainly Israel's not perfect.
Right.
But I do feel Israel seems to be held to a way higher standard than other countries. And I think it's what you're tired of doing is justifying, you know, Israel's existence.
Right.
What you're doing is you're kind of, you know, that's a given. Mm-hmm. We're not even going to have to justify, you know, Israel's right to exist. It exists, and it always will. But what we're going to do now is talk about the country and its beauty. And I think that's a far more, you know, positive. And I think that's a message that everyone can kind of get behind, because who doesn't like fashion and culture and film and music? And Israel has so much to offer the world.
But I have to say, and is the right conjunction. And I have to say that within this different paradigm, I can also talk about the conflict in a much more transformative way. Like the conflict doesn't become a, like, oh, let's hush because it's too controversial. Like, I can talk about, you know, I can talk about certain laws that the Israeli Knesset has passed, which I think are actually really moving things forward in terms of trying to invest in Arab communities in Israel. And trying to invest even in industries in Gaza and economies in Gaza.
Vespa, care to comment?
No, what she said.
Right. But I've actually found that perhaps the greatest advertisement for Israel are Israelis. And I've seen so many times in a school like Pratt that the Israeli students are just so, you know.
Yeah.
Open and chilled and sababa and you know, unlike, you know, the Orthodox kids from Long Island that haven't spent, you know, more than a week in Israel.
Yeah.
And it's very easy from the safety of Long Island to make all these, you know, proclamations of Bibi doesn't know what he's doing.
Yeah,
and,
all
it's very easy to suddenly be directing the IDF, you know, from Midwood. but I find that, you know, the Israeli students, such great advocates for Israel.
Yeah.
And I'll give you one example. We had a meal many years ago in my apartment. You know, I don't know everyone that you've been to my Shabbat table. Yeah. I don't know everyone that comes. I'm going around the table. I'm introducing myself.
Yeah.
And there's a student there. She tells me she's Palestinian.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, wow, that's interesting. You know, it was a little rare.
Yeah.
And I said to her, you know, what made you come? And her roommate's always talking about the rabbi. She said, I got to come meet the rabbi. I'm sitting in your apartment. She said, the food's basically the same.
Yeah.
The songs are basically the same. The people are basically the same. And she's sitting next to, a former, IDF soldier, extremely liberal.
Yeah.
And the fact that they were able to talk at a table, and I think that's something that me and Vespa have spoken at length about, and we're able to break bread and face each other.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't in a political setting. It was in a setting of love and family and connection and community. And I really, honestly, I felt like it was a beautiful moment.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. Anyway, the theory of enchantment.
That's a great segue.
We were.
And he's breaking bread.
Yeah, third principle. The theory of enchantment is.
It is.
Yeah.
Okay, so Chloe, you've I've noticed that you okay. How do we even get into this? Okay, so Chloe, several months ago, years ago?
Months.
Okay, Chloe, several months ago, you launched a new initiative.
Yes.
The Theory of Enchantment.
Yes.
I don't know what it is. I don't know who it is. I don't know why it is. But I keep seeing on my Instagram feed little pop cultural snippets entitled The Theory of Enchantment. Mm. And you've piqued my interest.
Yay.
Please explain for me and Vespa, the Altakakas in the room over here. You know the Yiddish phrase, Altakaka, Vespa?
I wouldn't know.
Look it up. Google it.
Oh, no. Oh, goodness. Okay, so... Bit of context.
I guess old fogies would be the... I apologize.
That's not so bad. So for context, I moved to New York almost 4 years ago. I moved here because I got a job at the Wall Street Journal. For the first 3 months, I was writing for the paper, op-eds. And for the remaining 9 months, I did a massive research paper on the topic of Israel and millennials. And during the over the course of producing that paper, I developed a theory called the Theory of Enchantment, which essentially begins by... It begins by destroying the myth, which was a myth that I believed in, that or the misconception rather, that anti-Semitism or fighting against anti-Semitism should be the impetus for getting people to like Israel. Instead, the impetus should be how do you actually get people to fall in love with Israelis? And and there's a difference between combating anti-Semitism, which is essentially saying how do you get people to stop hating, and getting people to fall in love with Israelis, which is a question of how do you get people to start loving. Those are two totally separate questions. Very interrelated, but different questions. So from that moment on, I said, okay, well, if I'm asking the question, how do you get people to fall in love with Israelis or fall in love with anything, then the question becomes, well, what are they already in love with? And how can I use that as a conduit to get them to fall in love with Israeli society? And for me, the biggest source of what people are in love with is pop culture. Pop culture shows you what we gravitate toward. That's why it's popular. So then I began to study corporations, companies, influencers that are famous in pop culture. Began to study Nike. Began to study the psychology of Beyonce. To ask the question. What is it about this content that people gravitate toward? And the common denominator was that All this content is content in which the audience sees themselves and their potential reflected in the content. So that's what Nike does. That's what Beyonce does to a certain extent. And that's why we gravitate toward. And so from then on, I said, if I can figure out, if this is what the psychology of connection is in many cases, then can I use that to solve and heal disconnection? So if I can look at a party where a DJ is playing music and she's really in sync with the audience, that's a moment of connection. What is going on there? Can I learn from that and use that psychology of connection to build connection in places where people are polarized? And so the Theory of Enchantment is essentially a model that aims to do that. It's three principles. Each principle is supplemented by stories, really. Real world stories and also stories found in pop culture. And the idea is to teach the Theory of Enchantment in different sectors of society where there's conflict. So you're talking about schools where there's bullying going on. If you're talking about geopolitics, right, Israel, if you're talking about domestic politics, Democrats and Republicans not getting along with each other, and even in business when high-powered teams aren't getting along with each other. So this company that I launched really serves to want to teach in these different sectors of society how to heal conflict and how to have productive conversations in a transformative way.
Vespa, can you explain the Theory of Enchantment for me? Because that was a lot. And you're a smarty pants.
Oh, gosh. I'm not very good at summarizing.
You are for the National Book Award.
Yes.
Mazel tov.
Thank you.
Explain it to me.
It sounds like you're teaching people how to see each other as humans.
Look at that. Wow.
I'm sorry.
So that's the first principle of the Theory of Enchantment. We are human beings, not political abstractions. And then I will use a pop culture reference to teach that. So,
example?
I'll teach Kendrick Lamar's song DNA, where he says, I got power, poison, pain, and joy inside my DNA. What he's doing in that rap song when he says that is he's articulating the complexity of what it means to be a human being. We all have the capacity to do good. We all have the capacity to do evil. It's in every single one of us. And if you can recognize it within yourself, then you can recognize it in the other, including the other that you're disagreeing with in a certain moment. And that creates a pathway for empathy.
Question, Chloe.
Yes. Yes.
How do you know that these messages are the intent of the content creators?
Well,
like, there's always that danger that you're just kind of piggybacking onto pop culture, yeah, and you're using the culture to, you know, to paint a picture and create a narrative.
Well, I think I just take things as they are. You know, if Kendrick Lamar, for example, has a track record, pretty strong reputation for
Look at me, I'm like challenging over
for,
here.
For creating...
Like 2020 over here.
Creating conscious hip-hop, you know. I think he won the Pulitzer in hip-hop for a reason. And one of those reasons is he has, you know, been known to talk about things that are critical for bettering society. Also, just in a lot of his interviews, he talks a lot about it. Like, he actually had an interview on something Jay-Z put out where he's talking about the need to create empathy. So I'm not even guessing when it comes to Kendrick. It's like very, like he said it himself. So
what's the second principle?
Second principle is criticize to uplift and empower, never to tear down and never to destroy. So the idea is that if I'm
a positive reinforcement.
Yeah, the idea is that, like, if someone is racist toward me, for
it's
example,
like parenting 101 here.
Or like less dramatically, I guess. Parenting also. But yeah, the idea is that if someone is racist toward me, I could curse them out. That's one option. Or I could, you know, call that behavior out as unacceptable and say, you know, I'm telling you this because I actually think that you can accomplish great things and you're not living up to your full potential. And that's also why I'm telling you this. I'm telling you this not only for my good, but for your good, because I believe in you. And I believe you have a great capacity to do amazing things. And I want you to fulfill that potential, which is a totally different approach from just, you know, cursing someone out.
Yeah. Vespa has a comment.
This is something that you learn in art school. It's a place where I think artists have a great deal to offer in training for constructive critique. You know, one of the first things they teach you in art school is that you don't criticize to tear down, you criticize to make your peer better. And that if you're being taught well, I guess, you know, that, that the more, the higher you push your peer, the higher you push your industry, you know, and it's good for everybody. Yeah. It's a net win for everybody. But, it's speaking the truth in love. It's like, you know, those two things have to go hand in hand. If love is without truth, then it's mush, it's vague. And if truth is without love, then it's just tearing down, yeah, you know, for its own sake. So
it's interesting because I just wrote a piece about how art in general, can teach us how to stop stereotyping each other and caricaturing one another, because great art, at least I'll say great art is really, or gives expression to the complexity of what it means to be a human being. I mean, you read like literature, great literature, and it's layered and it's nuanced and it's wrestling, right? It's not black and white. And that's what great literature does. That's what all great art does. So art in and of itself, I think, is a, and this is why I gravitate toward pop culture, because there's so much art in pop culture. Art is really and can be a resource for us to learn how to live better together, I think, ultimately.
I want to respond to that too by, you know, talking about something that I've noticed in the past few years. I think with social media, but just in general, the cultural conversation that we seem to be having right now is very censorious. And there's this culture of censorship, you know, because it's almost like there's like a fundamentalist religion in the air that if you may say X, but not Y. And so it's especially because if someone transgresses that on social media, for example, you'll get Twitter mobbed or whatever. And so people are beginning to self-censor. And the place that I ironically started to see this was in grad school among artists. And I started to get very alarmed because maybe I'm of a previous generation here where like the concept of censorship was you don't censor. Like censorship is a sin, you know? And so when I started to notice that it was the artists who were calling for censorship. Like, for example, there was one class that we had where younger classmates of mine were calling for new limitations on the First Amendment. And I thought, so I think you're right. Like, art, good art, you know, art that's free of those kinds of constraints can be really healing and can bring people together into new conversations. But
I actually think, and it's not that like I have a degree in psychology or anything, but I actually,
Sherry does.
Okay. So you can tell me if this is true or not, Sherry.
go ahead.
I have a feeling that a lot of these new movements in, like you said, that are super censorious, are come from insecurity.
Absolutely.
Ultimately. Fear. Sherry, true?
Like, would you ever live in Israel?
Yeah, I would. Specifically Tel Aviv. But yeah.
Sherry, you are content gold. And your Hasidic rabbi takes umbrage with the goy toy, but we'll get back. We'll pick that up at a later episode. I think... what's the third theory of enchantment?
Principle.
That Chloe, what's the third principle of enchantment?
The third principle of the theory of enchantment is everything we do, we root in love and compassion, which practically means that if someone is being hostile towards you, you call that behavior out as unacceptable, and then you invite that person to come break bread with you.
And if they don't receive you?
Then they don't receive you. But the idea is to always have that door open, because the point is not to agree on everything. The point is to bring back compassion and empathy, even in the midst of profound disagreement.
You know, there are three levels of tshuva in Judaism, which is actually parallels.
No way. Tell us. Yeah, what
yeah,
are
yeah,
they?
Yeah. We're off mic.
Oh, okay.
I'm going to send you a lot of stuff.
Okay.
You've tapped into something, but Vespa was jumping up and down at the third principle, in agreement.
Yeah,
Vespa.
All three principles.
Wow.
It happens to dovetail very nicely with where I'm thinking right now, because I go into schools and I talk to other people's kids about. The ugliness of the world and how bad it can truly be. And I'm under no illusions at all that these things are theoretical, because the human race has already gone there. And, you know, I think if you listen to, I listen to a lot of audiobooks. So if I say listening to a book, it's not because I'm lazy. It's because I have a lot of content to ingest. But if you read or listen to the first, you know, 5 minutes of like the Gulag Archipelago, you can't get away from the fact that this actually happened to real people in a country in our time.
A very civilized.
Very civilized country. Yeah. Whether it's Germany, whether
educated,
it's Russia.
Erudite.
I mean, cultured. I mean, right. You know, like advanced, technological,
seemingly civilized.
Well, you know, I mean, with right. Subways, okay? Right. You know, so like when you read about Solzhenitsyn getting on the subway, or like right. being accosted at a bar, right. you know, it's like, okay, that wasn't in the that's in the past, but not the distant past. So we can go there, right? So I'm going into schools and I'm like having to interact with students who have maybe a very theoretical, I won't say rosy, I don't think they have a rosy picture of the world, but they have a very theoretical picture of the world. And very soon they're going to go out there and make their way and be adults, either adding to or subtracting to the world, right? Right. So I want to just, in our little time together, give a little bit of tools, you know, to the students to help them navigate that, you know? And so... I've been meditating on this for the better part of a year now and thinking, gosh, how can I really help these kids? And it's come down in the last few months for me to the principle of love, which is not being taught. Yeah. It's like radical. Mm-hmm. Like the concept of love is completely revolutionary and radical. Like no one's ever thought of it before, mm-hmm. you know? And so I feel like we're in a really opportune moment. I'm actually really excited and, you know, optimistic about where we can go with this. And so I'm diving right back into the writings of Martin Luther King and just reacquainting myself with this person who's always been a hero, but whose message is widely misunderstood, but desperately needed right now. It's kind of like, if first century Israel, when the Romans were occupying, you know, like crazy time, like it's, there's a lot of parallels to our time right now. It's like we all want somebody, we want to see somebody in the Colosseum being fed to the bears, you know, like we're hungry for that, right? So, you know, along comes the message of love into that environment. It's exciting.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people say we're living in the 80s right now. And, you know, I wish we were living in the 70s. I wish we were living in the 70s.
80s were awesome. I don't know. This is not the
80s. That was a lot of, there was a lot of, in the 70s. I feel like there was a lot of.
70s.
We're living in the 80s. So some people say, I like the 70s. I like the vibe. I like the vibe of Israel in the 70s.
Yeah.
I think that was really cool, you know, the whole kibbutz thing and discos and all that. I think Israel was particularly hip in the 70s.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, that's what attracted my hippie biological dad there to do the kibbutz thing. He was an artist. So, you know, I need that vibe to exist, or, you know, that's the second part. So, yeah, that's, you know, bring that time back.
I have no idea what you just said, to be honest. Want to welcome Raymond, by the way. Raymond just walked into the synagogue. I don't know who you are, but you know what they say. Everybody loves Raymond. If you look at my bookshelf, Sherry, you'll see the Goonies lunchbox. That's my original lunchbox from high school. Roger Moore, circa The Spy Who Loved Me. And over here, we have The Karate Kid and Ferris Bueller's Day Off. So forget the 70s. About the 80s. Chloe, can I ask you a practical question?
Sure.
Me and Vesper have spoken about this on our last podcast. I find it very hard to go on Facebook anymore. Just, you know, that culture of everything is reduced to a thumbs up or a thumbs down. Everyone's maligning everyone. Picking sides, and things are getting very ugly very quickly. It's very hard for someone like me who's, I'm a centrist. I'm not, you know, I don't like to pick sides. I kind of swim around the middle. I'm kind of like a Joe Lieberman in comfy slippers. That's where I'm holding politically. I'm like a John Kasich. I'm a John McCain. You know, anyone with the first name John, that's sort of where I'm holding politically. And, you know, Arthur was the one that actually pointed me to Godwin's Law. If you're familiar with Godwin's Law, which is in the age of the internet, things get reduced to Hitler very quickly, because I think, you know, Hitler's the ultimate disruption. So if you want to win an argument, you're Hitler, and then it's very hard to argue that point once someone's been compared to Hitler. So how do I use the theory of enchantment? Let's say I'm on Facebook. It's getting ugly, and you know, people are getting taking sides very quickly, and I'm trying to engage, but I want to be at the center. I want to bring sides together. Seek equilibrium. Mm-hmm. So how do I use the theory of enchantment on a practical?
Sure. So the theory of enchantment is actually best used, and indeed it prides actual in-person engagement, because social media, despite its advantages,
Vespa just jumped out of his seat.
It's a very useful tool, but it's not like. People confuse social media for connection when it's really supposed to be a conduit for connection. But if you want to use it, if you're in a dispute on social media, whether it's Facebook or what have you, it's all about reorienting the paradigm. So usually if you're in a conflict situation, the other person will be like, you're here, I'm here, we can't see eye to eye. And that's just how it is. And also, you know, and then they'll throw in a curse word. Where the way to really...
And then bring up Hitler.
Right, exactly. Well, the way to really, I think, challenge that is to refuse to accept their premise of being their enemy. I find that that's actually quite fascinating as a first step. So it's someone is disagreeing with me on Israel, for example, who's like super anti-Israel, and she says all these various things that I don't like. And my response is, listen, I'm interested in pursuing a reality or a future where both of these communities who have experienced incredible pain and fear and trauma because of prolonged war can heal. Like, that is the reality that I am pushing for, and that is the future that I'm hoping for. And if that's something you're interested in, then regardless of our disagreement, that we can work together to achieve that future. But if that's not something you're interested in, I understand, but I'm not your person. But I wish you well in life and in love. So that's really about establishing first principles in a non-aggressive way and still wishing them well, even if they don't see eye to eye on that. So I found that, you know, this is about not wasting your time on social media, right? Like, you're not going to convince everyone to be on your side, and neither should you have that goal. But also, if you want to be more of a facilitator, you can facilitate that conversation. It's better to do it in person, but you can try to facilitate that conversation as a moderator. If you see two people on Facebook disagreeing, you can be like, well, listen, it looks like you have these values and this person has these values, and here's where they overlap and here's where they separate. And we don't have to talk about the separate part, but we can see where they overlap. But we can try to do something together because of that. So you can either be a facilitator in that role, or you can just very simply and nicely state that these are your first principles. This is the goal that you're working toward. It's okay if you don't share that goal. I wish you well.
And there is an overlap. You know, and I think so often, yeah, you know, especially in political sound bites, you know, conflict makes for content. So, you know, they always have, you know, and what do you think? And what do you, you know, but at the same, sometimes when I watch these snippets, I'm like, well, you know, he's got a point. And there is an overlap, but we forget about the overlap because we're living in this kind of, you know, the sound bites. We're just, everyone's trolling everyone.
I was on, I'm still on Facebook and Twitter, but I'm decreasing my involvement there. There was a kind of a sweet spot on Facebook where I was mediating a lot of, moderating a lot of discussion, because I have an extremely varied sphere of friends. And so maybe I'd put a topic on there and people from like 15 different sides of the thing would come and talk about it. And sometimes they would go for the other person's jugular or whatever. And so myself as a moderator could say, hey, this is what I know about this person. You know, he or she is actually a really great person, you know. But I'm finding that since the election of the current president, that kind of thing has become less and less possible. Sorry, three words in my head at once. Less and less possible. And so that combined with an extreme amount of loneliness that I faced after my book deal was announced and realizing that I had neglected my actual friendships for this sense of virtual connection that I thought was going to kind of be behind me. And also having the opportunity to be in person speaking to students and stuff, I'm decreasing my social media use purposely and really taking advantage of that, like being around the table with people and trying to get people in my home and that kind of thing.
I think what I'm hearing is the danger of isolation, whether it's virtual isolation, physical isolation, and the need for connection. That's what I'm... Okay.
Yeah, because you said something before, Chloe, about like insecurity, like insecurity and fear are killers. Like they'll cause you to do crazy things. Yeah. You know, fear is, it's like a parasite. It'll take over your mind. And you'll wind up doing and saying things you never thought you were capable of. That's how, you know, if we've got a whole, you know, couple million of people doing that, it's, you know.
Well,
yeah.
This is a very profound philosophical podcast. Sherry, note, next time we need to get the soccer hooligans back here. We need to get the soccer hooligans. Okay, this is a very philosophical and profound podcast. We need to get the soccer hooligans in next time. We're getting highbrow. We need to get lowbrow.
Season two, baby.
For some reason, I put season one when I started the podcast. So Sherry, we just started season two. Vespa, we have an event with you starting in 6 minutes from now. And poor Raymond, who walked in for the event, is sat alone. So we need to wrap up the podcast. By the way, Raymond, would you like to join us a moment? Come. I want to welcome Raymond on the Hipsid podcast. Raymond, we have currently 7,000 downloads. Raymond, say hello.
Hello.
Raymond, where are you from?
New Jersey.
Take a seat. Okay.
Welcome.
Note to Sherry, edit Raymond. Okay, so as we bring the podcast to a conclusion, how do we conclude? We got deep, but what's the...
Do you want me to conclude? I don't know.
Okay, so yeah. Okay. As we bring the podcast to a conclusion, I'd like to end off, Chloe. I feel like this is not the last time you're going to be on the Hipsid podcast, although I don't think you want to be. No. Okay. I got a feeling, nor Vespa. It's like every time, you know, I get out, they keep dragging me back in as Michael Corleone was. Theory of enchantment. There you go.
You're using pop culture to
say it with culture.
You're basically, by the way, all of this is just like giving a Torah portion, except you're not using the Torah. You're using
dude,
pop
that's,
culture.
That's all I have. You know me. That's literally all I do is give a Torah portion. Yes. All I do is give a spiel through culture. So I think I'm the living embodiment of the
absolutely
theory of enchantment. Okay, so Chloe, I'd like to just end off by if you could tell our 7,000, how many listeners? Okay, I believe there may be fake news over here. Chloe, I'd like to end off by if you could tell the listeners what's in the pipeline. For Chloe, what content are you producing, and how can we follow you, and how can we find you?
Sure, thank you for promoting me.
ABC.
So,
podcast there.
So I have a there's
culture.
A
culture. Always be closing.
Oh yes, always ABC, be closing.
Glenn Gary, Glenn Rush,
yes.
David Mamet.
He's going. Okay, so I have a podcast.
Show me the money. I'm sorry.
I have a podcast called Theory of Enchantment Podcast. It's a very new podcast, so check it out. It's all about empowerment. What's new?
I'm available, by the way.
I will definitely interview you,
just
Rabbi.
Saying.
My studio is available, too.
Awesome. I would love to use the studio. In terms of business, I'm now building curriculum for Theory of Enchantment. People have consistently asked for it. So to be able to come in and do one-day workshops, week-long workshops to teach the model. So if you guys know of any businesses or companies or organizations that would want to bring it in to service their needs, let me
beautiful
know.
Okay. Vespa? If you'd like to, we're going to close out. Tell the listeners some exciting news that's coming up in Vespa land.
Well, I'm working on a second illustrated young adult novel, also historical fiction, about the Great Plague of 1348. I like to keep it light. And in other news, I'll be illustrating a picture book biography of Jane Austen. It's kind of the dream project. Picture book written by Jasmine Sterling for Bloomsbury. So that was just announced, and I'm so excited.
There you go. The
Hipsid podcast. I get to draw
podcast
more pictures.
Highbrow. Okay, so this is what I want to end off with, Chloe. We're going to go around. This includes Raymond. We're going to go around, and I'd like everyone to say a line from pop culture that could be used.
Oh, I love that.
That could be used to educate and illuminate. I think we'll begin with Chloe.
So many references in pop culture. There's a line that I'm going to paraphrase from East of Eden, and it says, if a young boy has suffered rejection, then he will come to expect it even where it does not exist, and he will even draw it forth simply by expecting it.
Oh, beautiful. Okay, Vespa, if you'd like to
illuminate
through pop culture.
I'm so not good at pop culture, but I will answer in the immortal words of the prophetess Edie Brickell. What I am is what I am. Are you what you are or what?
Wow. Okay.
Nice.
Sherry, like to ask Sherry if you could give a Dvar Torah through pop culture.
From the wonderful world of 70s advertising. I'd like to buy the world a Coke and keep it company. Or in this case, I'd like to buy the world a Maim Chaim and keep it company.
Raymond, come. We're going to ask Raymond from New Jersey, who is very quickly regretting coming to this event. Raymond, you have a favorite line from pop culture, from movie, from song, from theater?
Hakuna Matata?
No. Oh, yeah.
All right, Raymond. Okay, so I'm going to end off with a quote from the prophet Tom Cruise. Tom Cruise says in the movie Vanilla Sky, he says, the little things, there is nothing bigger. So I want to thank everyone for tuning in to the Hipsit podcast. And everybody should check out The Theory of Enchantment. And everyone should remember that connection will always trump. That may be a trigger. Is there a different word?
Triumph over.
Oh, there you go. Connection will always triumph over isolation. Thank you.
Hipsit the podcast is recorded and produced by Sherry Barkley and Rabbi Simha. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review and thank you so much for subscribing.